Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. Whether real or imagined, diseases that turn into epidemics and ravage a population both horrify and fascinate us. And clearly, when the stories are told in a compelling way, they entertain us. If not for outbreaks, we wouldn't have TV shows like The Walking Dead or half the books written by Stephen King. If you watch or read these types of stories, you may enjoy the graphic details of imagined diseases. But do you have the stomach for the real medical and scientific facts surrounding the world's worst epidemics?
Our next guest is banking on your interest. Beth Skorecki is the author of Outbreak, 50 Tales of Epidemics That Terrorize the World. From obscure diseases like the sweating sickness in the time of King Henry VIII, to the worldwide outbreak of influenza in 1918, which killed 3% of the population, the book examines these outbreaks and their impact on society. Beth Skorecki is a science writer who covers life science topics such as molecular biology, human health research, and ecology. She's written for Public Health Perspectives, Life Hacker, Science Magazine, and Scientific American. Beth joins us from her office in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Take Care, Beth. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good to be here.
Why are we so fascinated with these types of outbreaks that you write about in your book?
Well, I think a big part of it is just that they're so dramatic. Anytime you read a story, the bigger and more epic it is, the better. And so when you have something where people are dying, you know, look at the Black Death, it's an entire continent. How can you not be drawn to that? But at the same time, we have some distance from it. Especially when you're looking back through history, you can say, okay, that was a whole continent where huge numbers of people died, but that was a long time ago. Even with Ebola, more recently, you can say, well, that's certainly a lot closer to home, but somewhat it's farther away geographically. And with a lot of these epidemics, we also have technology in between us too, right? That we can say, well, that was awful back then, but we have a vaccine against that now. Or you're reading about smallpox and we've eradicated that. So I think it makes it a little bit safe to mentally, psychologically safer to read about these things, huge, big stories that changed life, that changed history. They're sensational. They write their own headlines. So I think they're both dramatic, but we have just enough distance to be able to appreciate them as stories rather than just be depressed or scared about them.
I was interested to see that your book, Outbreak, isn't just about the disease itself, but you do bounce around the globe and you span incredible amounts of time and you look at how different parts of the world handled illness and contagion. So, you know, one of the earliest stories is about malaria in 10,000 BC, and that was a worldwide outbreak. And then you revisit it again in 1630 in Peru when a cure is discovered. And then you also cover leprosy. You talk about it in 13th century Europe, and then you talk about it again in 1866 in Hawaii. So why did you decide to revisit epidemics at different times in human history?
So from like a biology nerd point of view, I think it would be great to look at one germ or one disease and say, okay, well, how does this work? But to really put it in context of these epidemics that are really the way we understand a lot of these diseases, because it was this epidemic, because it was that epidemic. And I think it's really interesting to see how people handled it in different ways at different times. With leprosy in the 13th century, or people then didn't know very much about what it was or how it was transmitted or what exactly you can do about it. And there's also reason to believe that it may have been either the disease was a little bit different or the people were a little bit different back then in terms of who was susceptible, because it was a lot more transmissible than it is nowadays. So the really interesting thing about leprosy is that leprosy was a thing and still is today, but around the time they were exiling people on this specific part of Hawaii, they kept doing that even after we had an antimicrobial treatment for it. And you really get into like the social factors of it about why were people thinking this disease was so much worse than other diseases, which from a purely scientific perspective, it isn't necessarily. And so there are so many ways that culture and history affects how we approach a disease, and then it comes right back that lots of diseases have in different ways changed history and changed our culture. So I think that's just a fascinating interplay there. And when you take these little samples from, you know, throughout time and space, you can get different little pieces of that story.
I want to go back to something that you said about culture and history, because one of the things that comes up is the bubonic plague. Many people know it as the Black Death. And you cover it both in China and in Europe. And this is around the same time frame. But as you point out in the book, there is literature on it about its effects in Europe, but not so much in China.
Mm-hmm.
So what about that cultural difference? Does that speak to how a population addresses disease, or whether or not information is available or recorded? Any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I was researching this book, I was really coming up in so many places against the fact that I only have what people have written about, and what people have written about and that survive to the current time and that at some point has been translated into a language that I can read. This book, you know, as much as I hate to say it, almost all of it is, centers around, you know, like Europe and Western culture, you know, and I tried to branch out as much as I could. So there's that that barrier in terms of availability of information. But then also, you know, if you go back to that time, back then, you know, this was when having, like, easy-to-travel routes between East and West was kind of a new thing. And, you know, and so, like, a disease was one of the first things to be transmitted, and that's sort of a theme that you see throughout the book and throughout history, is that as soon as people start to be able to meet each other and talk to each other, they're also passing diseases along, too. And so, you know, like, disease is part of culture almost, you know, that it you know, when two cultures meet, their diseases will meet too. So I think that's sort of a fascinating aspect of it. And I really wish I knew more about what happened on the other side of that divide. And actually, since you mentioned, you know, like China and East meets West thing, one thing that I was able to find as I was digging through some of this stuff was looking at smallpox. And so a lot of us have heard about the smallpox vaccine that came from cowpox and Edward Jenner and all this stuff. And if you dig past that a little bit further, you find out there is this woman, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who was British, and her husband was an ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And so when she visited there, she found out that they were routinely immunizing people against smallpox. And it turns out you can take that back even farther. They were doing it in Africa in the 1600s. They were doing it in China in at least the 1600s. And I include that in the book in, like, the legendary, like, the legend of where immunization started in China. They say it was around 1000 AD, which maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But it was certainly a long time before that kind of vaccination was a thing in Western Europe. And so that was another thing that, like, culturally, the way that, you know, like, English and European physicians practiced medicine, immunization didn't make sense to them. They had heard of it, and it just didn't. They were like, "No, that's not how this works."
And they also mentioned that somewhere in the book you highlighted that a physician basically had said to Lady, "You have to give me her last name again."
Lady Mary Wortley Montagu.
Yes, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu wanted to pursue this, and a physician essentially said to her, because the inoculation, the primitive way they did it, came from a woman, and there was something about women's medicine can't possibly match up to mm-hmm. the way we practice it. But we're going to revisit that. But just if you are just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And our guest today is Beth Skwarecki, and she's the author of Outbreak, 50 Tales of Epidemics That Terrorize the World. So I want to talk briefly about that whole idea of immunization. And then I will ask about those graphic diseases, some of them which you highlight in the book, because as I said, you know, the public does have a taste for some of this stuff. So in terms of the inoculation, it was very obviously today it's delivered through a needle. But mm-hmm. back then it was rubbed on the skin. How did that happen?
So if you think back, like, smallpox, as far as I know, smallpox was the only one that people were really vaccinating for. And the word vaccine comes from this, like, cowpox thing. So we should really say immunizing, or at the time they would say inoculating or variolating. So they were doing this with smallpox and not with other diseases. And I don't know if anybody's really asked why. But one thing we know about smallpox is it makes these, like, these pustules all over your skin. And so people would either take the fluid from inside of there, or they would take the scabs that would form. And so the version that came to Europe through the, like, Ottoman Empire and that sort of area through the Middle East they would sort of scratch your skin open. They would make a little cut or a scratch, and then they would put some of this, you know, like this lymph or pus or whatever this material was that they had, and they would try to get it, like, under your skin, into your bloodstream. And probably that made sense because it was, you know, a sore on your arm, and so you would put it into a sore on somebody else's arm. If you go back even further, one of the ways they did it in China was they would actually do it through your nose. So they would either have like a little bit of fabric or something dipped in this material and put it in your nose and tell you, like, keep it in your nose for the rest of the day. Like, they would do this for kids. Or they would do that, or they actually had a way that they would, like, grind up the scabs and, like, use sort of like a pipe to, like, puff it up into your nose. And looking back, we know now that smallpox is spread through, like, coughs and sneezes through the air kind of thing. And so, you know, like, how did they figure that out? Or was it just sort of an accident? So we don't know. You know, in modern times, using a, you know, like a vaccine with a needle the way that we do it works pretty well for a lot of things, although not everything. There's a polio vaccine that's used in the developing world that's an oral vaccine. We have a rotavirus vaccine that's like that, too. You just put a few drops in a baby's mouth. But, yeah, that's really interesting how this has changed over time. And we don't really know why people vaccinated against smallpox in the way that they did.
All right, so if we haven't horrified our listeners enough, I will just give an advance warning because I'm going to ask about maybe one, maybe two if we have time. You have highlighted some very unique diseases which are difficult to read about. One of them was the Guinea worm. Tell us a little bit about that and when it struck.
So the good news about Guinea worm, I'll skip to the end. The good news is it is almost eradicated. The bad news about the good news is that it has been almost eradicated for, 20, 30 years now. But we're getting close. So the guinea worm is something that, so you drink the eggs or the larvae of this worm. And so this worm grows inside your body, and it gets longer and longer. And it will mate with another one inside of your body. And it will tunnel its way through your body, like out of your gut and through all the rest of your body. And they tend to go downward, so you're most likely going to have it coming out your leg or your foot. And it actually manages to hide from your immune system. Like your body has no idea this thing is in there until it's ready to come out. And so the female worm, so the male just dies, like somewhere in your body. The female worm, you know, basically eats her way to your skin, somewhere around your foot maybe, and then and only then do you start having like this burning, itching pain, and it feels so horrible, and the only thing that makes it feel even a little bit better is to put your foot into cold water. And we think this is like an adaptive thing that the worm has, in a sense, figured out, because as soon as it knows that it's in water, it sort of barfs out its eggs, right? So there's like something like 3 million eggs inside of this worm. And so it sort of spits that out into the water, which means those eggs are now in the water for somebody else to drink. But that's not the end of it, because this happens over and over and over again until the worm is basically used up. And so this worm, if you could pull it out, which is what you have to do, but you have to do it very slowly and carefully, this worm is basically a 3-foot-long piece of spaghetti, and it is packed full of microscopic eggs. So the pain that people have is bad enough that, you know, and this still exists today, it's bad enough that people can't work. And, you know, if a lot of people in a village have it, that, you know, sort of destroys that village's ability to farm and for people to take care of themselves. And this is a very old disease. We've found guinea worms in mummies. So we know that it's been around for a very long time.
Beth, I wanted to ask you about something you referenced earlier, and that is really the social and cultural reaction to some of these outbreaks. You describe in your book how certain societies, and this only happens when you have no idea how things are spread, because that leaves a vacuum and people come up with theories, and they were killing people right and left selectively in some societies that they suspected might be carriers of some of these diseases. And of course, later we find out that's not the case at all. But you fast forward to society today with the AIDS epidemic and also Ebola, and you can see you can see reactions that are similar in on the spectrum in terms of overreaction. I'm thinking of that poor nurse that was quarantined in a tent in New Jersey a few years ago. And again, that's because we didn't think she was contagious, but nobody wants this to spread, so we take an abundance of caution. Yet whatever it is in human nature that you described years ago seems to be true today. Would you speak to that, just the cultural and social reaction to an outbreak that's so scary and threatening?
Yeah, and absolutely, I see parallels throughout this. Like, even when we do know what causes it, right? We know what causes Ebola, but we still, you know, somebody still chose to put her in that tent, you know, and it reminds me a little bit of Typhoid Mary. Typhoid Mary actually was able to transmit typhoid, but she was, you know, like this poor Irish immigrant and, you know, and got on somebody's bad side at the public health office in the first place. And she ended up getting locked away for life simply because, you know, she would sometimes have this germ that she could pass on to other people. There were, you know, by the time she died, there were hundreds of other known spreaders of typhoid in New York. So this is New York City where this happened. And judges were saying, well, this person has to, you know, just make sure not to spread the disease because I'm not going to take his livelihood away from his family, you know. So because she was a woman, an unmarried woman, she was more likely to get, you know, locked away. Like, she was the only one that they did this with. And you can look at all of these, you know, I can just think of so many examples. Like when bubonic plague hit San Francisco, it was in Chinatown first. And so one of the first things that people did, even while they were, you know, trying to do some lab tests to confirm that it was bubonic plague, because at this point we did know what plague was, they said, well, we're going to quarantine Chinatown. But they very carefully drew the quarantine line so that if you were a Chinese person who lived in Chinatown, you couldn't get out, you know, even to go to work. You know, a lot of these people went to work for places outside of Chinatown. But they also very carefully drew the line so that if there were white people living nearby, that they weren't in the quarantine area. And they would let some people cross the quarantine line, but not others. And this very quickly looks more like xenophobia and less like a public health effort. So I think there are a lot of these examples, you know, in many of these stories where people are afraid of disease, but they also use that as that sort of intersects with their fear of people who are different than them. I think one of the things you were mentioning was about how in the Black Death, you know, people would go and round up Jews and kill them because they figured they must be at fault somehow. And so it's not that the disease is triggering people to, you know, be awful people. It's more like it's sort of giving them an excuse and letting it come out, I think. That's sort of my reading on it.
Beth Skorecki is a science writer whose latest book is called Outbreak, 50 Tales of Epidemics That Terrorize the World. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you. This has been fun.